did your mom think you would make a good lawyer?
She told me it was because I had a big mouth. And
you could have been a politician.
Yeah, well, that, she had some boundaries.
Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes.
The growing phenomenon of midlife eating disorders, not just among teenage girls.
A look at why more adults are being treated for these conditions.
Then a retired boomer travels the country as a National Park Service volunteer.
Plus, what was it like to be a female litigator when women in these positions were virtually non-existent? One woman's story of paving the way.
And we'll shoot the breeze about 50 ways to celebrate the Big 5-0. If you were asked to conjure up an image of someone with an eating disorder, chances are you'd see a thin teenage girl. Eating disorders are diagnosed primarily in adolescence, but experts say more and more adults are being treated in midlife and even older. So what's going on?
Cynthia Bulick has some answers. She's a professor of eating disorders at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. She's also the author of Midlife Eating Disorders. Cynthia joins us on the phone from Chapel Hill to talk about this surprising and growing phenomenon. Welcome to the program, Cindy.
Thanks for having me.
So what are the most common types of eating disorders that generally appear in midlife?
We have three major eating disorders out there: anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. I think most people have heard about anorexia and bulimia, but what they don't realize is the most common eating disorder is actually binge eating disorder. And what that is it's binge eating, or eating an unusually large amount of food in a short period of time and feeling out of control, but in the absence of those compensatory behaviors, such as vomiting, laxative abuse, or exercise. What you need to distinguish between is just overeating and binge eating. And I think everybody knows what you feel like post-Thanksgiving dinner, where you've had one too many servings of everything. That's overeating. But a binge is really when you start eating, you feel like you can't put the brakes on, that sense of out of control, and then feeling distressed, or guilty or upset about the binge afterwards. That's really the psychological piece that isn't there with just overeating.
So it's more emotional eating.
Emotions are often the triggers. So when we really ask people, you know, what set off that binge episode, often it might be something like stress or anxiety or boredom. So emotional triggers are very common.
How prevalent are eating disorders in middle-aged people?
We know that eating disorders are not rare. That's another one of those misconceptions. Believe it or not, over 14 million people in the United States have eating disorders. And what we've seen in treatment programs around the country is a 40 to 50% increase in the number of people over 35 seeking treatment.
Now, is this more common in women than men?
For anorexia and bulimia, we do see a somewhat lopsided ratio, so more common in women than in men. But in binge eating disorder, the ratio isn't that much off. So we're actually seeing almost comparable numbers, maybe with just slightly more women. So the official numbers are 3.5% of women and 2% of men in the country have binge eating disorder.
Cindy, why would a baby boomer, say with no history of an eating disorder, develop one in midlife?
We're seeing three patterns. We're seeing some people who, if you look back into their adolescence, they might have had eating disorders, and then they sort of went underground, or the symptoms might have just smoldered throughout their 20s and 30s and 40s. And then there's some trigger later in life, like divorce, or interestingly, menopause is a big trigger, or retirement, or empty nest syndrome, that seem to be the trigger for that eating disorder to come back.
That has a lot to do with the development of an eating disorder, sort of a hormone imbalance?
Well, it absolutely does, because we know, for example, that puberty is a big risk factor for eating disorders. And puberty and menopause are sort of like hormonal bookends for women. They really do sort of mark these two periods of hormonal upheaval. And anybody who's been through it or is going through it know that menopause affects your ability to regulate your temperature. It affects your mood. It affects your appetite. It affects your weight. And it sort of changes the way your body's configured.
Check, 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 check,
exactly.
Cindy.
Exactly. You know, women say, I woke up one morning, I looked in the mirror, and I said, who stole my waist? And
right. That's
like the most common thing. And a lot of these are very much related to appetite regulation. Or they can drive people to extremes in order to try to change them. So those desperate attempts to get the pounds off when you're going through menopause can be the first step in that slippery slope toward an eating disorder.
Can hormonal changes, for example, like in menopause, affect food, food cravings?
They definitely can. So, lots of women will say, well, you get this through your whole life. And people will say, before their periods, they would develop carbohydrate cravings. Women say the same thing in menopause, that sometimes their cravings and their appetites go wonky during that period. And sadly, I don't think we have enough research.
Now, have you done any research about hormone replacement therapy during menopause and if that helps curb these cravings?
Believe it or not, we're in the middle of a study like that right now. One of my postdocs, Jess Baker, is working on that because we really want to know what's happening.
Well, keep me posted because I'd love to know too.
And I'm also curious, does the same happen with men?
Interestingly, given that they don't have the same menopausal transition, not so much, but we are seeing more men in this age group coming in for treatment for binge eating disorder. And some of the triggers are the same. And I think a lot of people look forward to the empty nest or retirement sort of in a Pollyanna way, like everything's going to be great. But all of a sudden they realize that they don't have a lot of things to fill their day, and they fill up that vacuum basically by the pantry. So they find themselves sort of eating away their days. And yet what I tell people is, just because you've retired doesn't mean your eating disorder has. And I think that's what we're seeing, retirement as a trigger.
Now, are eating disorders more dangerous for a middle-aged person?
Eating disorders take a toll on your body no matter what your age. But when you're older and your body is less resilient, we're seeing even more medical complications. So some of the things that we're seeing is we're seeing more cardiac problems, so problems with your heart. We're seeing more osteoporosis. We're also seeing a lot of gastrointestinal problems. So we're seeing a lot of acid reflux, stomach problems, and irritable bowel. And the one thing people don't think about is your teeth. So if you happen to be vomiting as part of bulimia and your teeth have already started to age, that exposure to the stomach acid when you're vomiting can really take a toll on your teeth. Providers don't even have it on their radar screen that this is something that one of their 50, 60, or 70-year-old patients might be suffering from. And I've heard some providers say, oh, come on, haven't you grown out of that yet?
You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour, and we're talking about the surprising prevalence of eating disorders later in life. Our guest, Cynthia Bulick, a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and the author of Midlife Eating Disorders. I would think that the impact of an eating disorder would really be much different for an adult than it is for a teenager. I mean, for a teenager, the parents would be most affected, I mean, besides the child, of course. But an adult has a spouse and kids and a job.
Right. You've hit all the high points. And I think one of my older female patients said to me, there's a lot of collateral damage when you have an eating disorder when you're 50. And what she was talking about is the very negative impact that it had on her relationship. Her husband really suffered along with her with this eating disorder. And she also had difficulty at work, and she had trouble with her kids. She really started to have difficulty parenting. And part of that is just really struggling with being able to continue on as a mom or as a grandmom without having your eating disorder interfere.
I would think the treatment would it be different for an adult than for a teenager?
The one thing that is different is we know for teenage eating disorders that one of the best approaches is to actually bring your parents in. So the parents become part of the treatment plan, with family-based treatment. If you're 50 or 60, it's kind of hard to bring mom and dad in for treatment, so we had to come up with alternatives. So one of the things that we're doing that we're really excited about is we've developed a couple-based treatment for anorexia nervosa, where we bring the partner into therapy with the patient, and they develop a recovery plan together using couple therapy. And honestly, it is the most exciting advance in anorexia nervosa treatment that I've been involved with or that I've seen in the past 30 years in this field. Planning on moving that into bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder as well. But otherwise, we're using a lot of the same principles, like cognitive behavioral therapy, for the treatment of eating disorders in adults.
What about medication?
It depends which eating disorder we're talking about. So for anorexia nervosa, there are really no medications that work for that disorder. And that's something that we really need to do more work on and more research. For bulimia nervosa, Prozac or fluoxetine is the only FDA-approved medication that we have for the treatment of bulimia, but it's not enough. It might help get a handle on the binge eating, both for bulimia and binge eating disorder, but it really doesn't give you those tools that you need for long-term recovery. That's where the psychotherapy comes in.
What is the recovery rate?
Again, it differs across the disorders. So for anorexia nervosa, we see about 25% of people who develop a chronic or relapsing course. And unfortunately, anorexia has the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. So don't be lulled into thinking that this is just a passing fad, because it's not. And then another 25% of those folks go on to fully recover, and about 50% sort of have some of those smoldering symptoms. For bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder, the story is actually a little bit more positive. So we're seeing more like 60% full recovery. So the take-home message is recovery is possible from all of these eating disorders.
Cindy, what advice do you have for a woman now in midlife who became anorexic as a teenager but is still struggling as one?
It's never too late to go in and get a complete evaluation, and that's really the first step. And I urge people to do that, just of how important it is to have a professional cast his or her eyes over your symptoms, do a complete evaluation. And when you are in midlife or beyond, well, actually at any time, that has to include a thorough medical evaluation as well. And then that person can help you develop a treatment plan that fits in with your lifestyle and is developmentally appropriate for this time of your life. And, you know, given that all providers don't know this and aren't aware of eating disorders in midlife, sometimes you have to go in armed with information. You have to go in with my book or go in with an article that says this happens in people my age and I need help.
Who do you go to first, your internist, your general practitioner?
There are lots of different avenues in. So one could be your primary care physician, whoever that might be. You could go to see a dietitian first. You could go to see a psychologist first. The important thing is just getting your foot in one door as a way to get to an entire treatment team so that you can really be treated holistically.
You also caution against low-carb diets, which are obviously so popular these days. Why is that?
I just caution against diets, frankly.
Just don't diet. Just eat a healthy meal.
The data are just so clear that diets don't work and that diets are the best way to gain weight and that diets will also contribute to the development of binge eating disorder. So the goal is, and this sounds like something that all of our grandmothers told us, eat a healthy breakfast, eat three meals a day and probably two healthful snacks in between, and keep that structure regular. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing better than healthy eating and regular eating to make you and your body happy.
Do you see these statistics getting better anytime soon?
Not without attention. And that's exactly why we're doing this kind of a show, because I think we have to become completely aware of how big the problem is. We need to make sure that we're developing treatments that are tailored to people in midlife and beyond, and not just assuming that what we do with adolescents is going to work with adults. Part of this is really getting the medical establishment's attention, developing appropriate treatments, getting people identified and treated, and then we'll start seeing the numbers go down.
Cynthia Bulick, author of Midlife Eating Disorders, thank you so much for being on the show and making us boomers aware of this very real issue.
Thanks for addressing the topic. I really appreciate it.
Up next, traveling the country as a National Park Service volunteer. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
While vacationing in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, my husband and I decided to tour the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. After climbing to the very top, we met a terrific guy named Steve Sox. We quickly learned his adventurous story. He retired from the radio business a few years ago, but instead of basking in the sun in Miami Beach, Steve decided to sign up with the National Park Service as a volunteer. Now he travels all over the country in his RV, working at various national parks.
What a fabulous way to spend a boomer day. Steve joins us from his latest posting in South Carolina. Great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Barb and Kathy. It's good to talk to you too.
So I'm sure you've had lots of post-retirement options. So why the National Park Service?
When I was still working, I used to do a lot of camping and traveling in the different parks, and I kept seeing people in campgrounds parked there. It said camp host, and got to talking to those folks. They were volunteers. They retired, and they did a little bit of work, and they gave them a place to live there in the campground. And I thought, what a great way to see the country, really, you know, like go for a while, like several months, and immerse yourself into something. So that's what really led to that. As I began to move out on my own, I realized there was a lot more interesting and fun things to do in addition to just doing campground hosting. So that's how I got started.
So, Steve, is it difficult to start over at a new posting? Is it tough?
Probably the toughest part of it is that, you know, you do get some training when you go, you know, go into a new position, but a lot of it is just baptism by fire. Out you go. Here's your hat, here's your shirt, and you're out there with a brochure. That's probably the hardest part. Is it was very intimidating when I first started, is that how am I going to learn all these things about the lighthouse or the fort where I'm working? How am I going to learn this that quickly? The thing that I've discovered was is that there's an old rule called the 80-20 rule, and I'll turn that around. I found out that there's probably about 20 questions that you're going to be asked about 80% of the time. And you can knock those out pretty quickly, and you'll feel pretty confident when you do that. Those questions are kind of funny because they'll vary in every park except for the number one question. It's the same number one question at every park.
Well, we've got to know what it is.
I think I know, but go ahead.
You do? You want to take a guess?
It's not where is the library.
No.
It's what any self-respecting female would ask.
It's like, where is the bathroom?
Bingo. I've asked it many times myself.
Yes. Well, now, Steve, tell us about your latest posting. Where on earth are you? We know you're in South Carolina.
I'm with the National Park Service. I'm at Cowpens National Battlefield, which is a Revolutionary War park. And this was a battle that was fought in 1781 here. And it's a very interesting story as the British were trying to move north in the latter parts of the Revolutionary War. It was one of the significant turning points that really thwarted them moving northward. So I'm working here at the Visitor Center, talking with people, handing out brochures, pointing different directions and doing things like that. It's a great job. It really is.
Well, you've certainly picked up the historical facts rather quickly.
Oh, you have to. You have to. It's really interesting that the other thing about working in the parks like this is that you need to know about the park, but you need to know about the community as well. I work for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Sonoma County, California, and you had to know all about the park, all about the fish hatchery that was there and everything else. Well, we happen to be right in the middle of the Russian River Valley, and you better know also which winery out here makes the best Zinfandel. Because you're going to be asked that question, too.
Oh, we could learn that one
pretty quickly. I would like that job. We could taste test, Barbara.
The research for that was excellent.
I can imagine. So, Steve, did they give you a script, or is it written all over your hands and your arms, or how do you do that?
They give you a lot of the core information, you know, but not a script, no. Just some key points and things. For example, there's some very important things you need to convey, like we met at the lighthouse, Kathy, and
right.
You know, the thing was, you have a safety talk. You need to tell people about certain things that you need to include them. But interestingly enough, you don't get a script. And one of the things they encourage is to be very, very communicative with people. You know, one of the fun things at the lighthouse was I told people, I said, you know, I first climbed that lighthouse in 1959. And you tell people that is the start of the safety talk, and you've got them in your hand. They thought, how cool, this guy's still around. So.
Steve, do you know ahead of time what your position will be, or is it just a big surprise when you arrive, like, oh, wow, I'm going to be on bear watch today?
No, it's pretty clear that you go and look, and that's the other thing that's very important, I think, for people to understand, is that where I go and where I work and when is up to me. As a volunteer, I will work with the Park Service, but there's other agencies, too. I mentioned the Corps of Engineers, and so I will be looking at what jobs are available and what they are asking people to do and select one that kind of fits, and then you interview with them. It's very much a job interview. They check references at other parks where I've worked and things like this before they will put me out there. But you kind of know what you're getting into before you go.
Well, how long does it actually take to be selected as a volunteer?
I've had it happen I've had it happen, you know, within the matter of just a couple of days. You know, you send an application, everything done by email, of course, and, you know, just in a couple of days, they'll check references and call up and say, hey, Steve, we'd like you to come to New Mexico. So I've had it happen that quickly.
Wow. Now, do they pay for you to get there, or that's just all on your own volunteer dollar?
You know, each and every agency is going to differ in what you get in return for your volunteer efforts. I have never seen anybody that would pay my mileage. And as we all know, with those motorhomes and fuel costs, that's a pretty expensive proposition to move a motorhome across the country. But no, I'm not aware of anybody that covers that expense. This is where I always say that disclaimer line, check with your tax consultant. But, you know, you can deduct mileage for volunteer services. So maybe there's a little thing in there that would help you. I just don't know about that, though.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
We are speaking with National Park Service volunteer Steve Sachs about opportunities for adventurous volunteers. More to come when we return after the break.
This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com.
Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be.
OnePriceTaxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free, and unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed.
You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes, Kathy and Barb, and we're talking with Steve Sachs, a retiree who now spends time as a National Park Service volunteer. Steve, we were talking about all the different volunteer opportunities for people. Is there a job for everyone, or do you really have to be the real outdoorsy kind?
A lot of people are retired as couples, and they're traveling and doing this. And one of them may have no problem and love meeting people and working with them and leading tours and talking to them, this kind of thing. And somebody may want to do something else. And you frequently see opportunities at parks to do work in a visitor center or lead tours. But there's also opportunities that can be clerical. There can be maintenance jobs that are available. There's all kinds of positions that are available for people to work. So many different jobs, and they're usually very accommodating for a couple to come in.
Steve, how do we find out about these opportunities?
There is a website that has a lot of listings, but not all, and I really want to emphasize that. There's a website called volunteer.gov, and on it you will find listings for many of the National Park Service locations. You will also find other agencies that are listing on there well, like the U.S. Forestry Service, Fish and Wildlife, different agencies like that. But there's a lot of places that do not put their listings on there. For example, state parks. A lot of state parks don't. And what you can do is just go to your state, you know, the state you'd be interested in, go to their website. You'll probably find a tab about volunteerism and check on that. Also, some of the national parks don't put opportunities on this site as well. So if there's a park you're interested in and you don't see a position on there, by all means, look at the park's website. They usually have contribute to your park or something like that, and you'll find a volunteer tab there that'll give you more information, and you can contact the parks directly.
And then you hear so much about all these budget cuts, and I would assume it impacts the National Park Service, right?
It does, and it's been very evident to me. I've been getting a lot of phone calls from different organizations where I have applied or where I have worked. It is a great time to help serve and maintain these resources for the public, great natural resources that we have for the public to enjoy.
Well, Steve, how long do you plan to do this?
I don't know. I don't have a plan. I kind of thought maybe when I got to this point in this age in my life that I'd be at the point where I was going to settle down. I'll have this plan and know what I'm doing. And sometimes I'll be sitting here and not know what I'm doing in another month or two. It's actually kind of exciting. It's really fun to go to that website and all of a sudden you see something pop up on there like Idaho and you go, wow, I haven't been to that place.
I don't even know where it's located.
I know it's square.
Start up the motorhome and here we go. What fun. I'm just having a ball. I really am.
Steve, which have been your favorite postings?
Absolutely. And, you know, I met Kathy at the lighthouse, and that was to be every day I would spend 2 hours up on the very top of the lighthouse on the balcony. And that was absolutely one of the most wonderful places that I ever worked. The other one that I really liked because of the unique piece of our history and the absolute beauty was north of Seattle, and it's the San Juan Islands National Historical Park. And it was a combination of an interesting piece of our history, a border dispute with Great Britain, and one of the most beautiful settings in America. Those two in particular stand out, but I've had great experiences everywhere. I really have.
Steve Sachs, National Park Service volunteer, you're one inspiring boomer dude.
Well, thanks.
Okay, see you on the road, Steve.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, Barbara, so I went on that website, volunteer.gov, and I found some opportunities for us.
Oh, no. Here it comes.
Just in case we get a little break from the show. How about this one? We could be summer RV hosts in Sitka, Alaska.
Where's that, Kathy?
It's up there somewhere. I'm not sure that time of year, but listen to the job description. We greet visitors, clean 8 restroom stalls.
Okay, you lost me with the clean the restroom stalls. Next one.
Get this one. We prevent crowding of bears by onlookers.
Oh.
What do you think? And $30 a day per couple.
That might sweeten the pot.
Yeah.
But we'd have to split it.
Okay, now listen to this. Shuttle bus volunteer host in Sequoia National Park, California.
That sounds a little bit better. Maybe air conditioning, comfy seats.
Oh, sure. But we provide info on shuttle buses and hiking trails. And guess what? The best part? We get a uniform and a radio.
Oh, I can just see us, Kathy.
Can you see it? Like right on our belt or something? We could put the radio. Doesn't it sound great? And cabin housing.
Ooh, I'd rather have the Four Seasons, but I'll take it. Okay, Kathy, that's enough. Up next, paving the way for women in the world of law, a trailblazing boomer shares her story.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Sunday mornings ago, I was sitting in my comfy chair, sipping coffee and reading the Washington Post, My Idea of Heaven, when a story caught my eye. It really spoke to me. It was a short piece about Judy Harris, a senior partner in a DC law firm who also happens to be a boomer. I was intrigued about her career path, the pull and tug of being a working mom, and what it was like to be a female litigator when women in those positions were virtually non-existent.
What struck Barb and me is how much has changed in just a few decades later. Women are now the majority in law schools. No one thinks twice about a woman in the courtroom, so we're delighted to have Judy Harris join us in our studios to talk about her literal trials and tribulations being an attorney just before the floodgates opened to women. Great to have you with us, Judy.
Thank you both. Great to be here.
Well, we can totally relate to coming of age in that really kind of gray area where our parents expected us to go and graduate from college, but also kind of find a husband who could support us. And I have to tell you, Judy, I have a Jewish mother just like yours.
So you know of what I speak.
But it was kind of a gray area back then, wasn't it?
I think we were getting very ambivalent signals, especially from our mothers. I don't think they meant them to be ambivalent. My mother really encouraged my sister and I to pursue professional careers. She was a brilliant woman, had majored in math at the University of Michigan. She was a fabulous mother, but I think she had never really felt fulfilled professionally. She stayed at home mostly. Was married to my dad 62 years. They never didn't have lunch together in 62 years. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, never spent a night apart. Those were her choices. I think she wanted something different for us, but I also think that she was very conflicted about it because she really believed that it was so important to be a good wife, to be a good mother. It was important to be a mother.
Well, I think if your mom was like my mom, she really wanted me to be able to stand on my own 2 feet because, you know, she would say, you never know what the future holds.
That's exactly what it was with my mother. And I don't think they understood so well, the mothers of that generation, that it was a little bit difficult to sort of get that professional degree, do what you needed to do to get to that point, and then just let it sit on the shelf with the notion that you could go back and pick it up 20 years later if your husband walked out on you. I don't think they had the complete vision of exactly what it was going to take to make it in that world.
Well, now, why did your mom think you would make a good lawyer?
She told me it was because I had a big mouth.
You could have been a politician.
Yeah, well, that, she had some boundaries. She used to always say to me, Judy, you're such a big mouth. You would make such a great lawyer. I'm not even sure she knew what a lawyer was or did or, you know, other than Perry Mason. And my sister, who was very sweet and unassuming, and she used to always say, you are so kind, Pam. You would make a great doctor. And so that's exactly what we each did.
Well, at least you picked some good professions,
yes.
You know, better than.
Yes.
Well, do you think if you had brothers, do you think your mom would have been as insistent that you become a lawyer and your sister a doctor?
I've never really thought about that. I think it might have depended a little bit on our birth order. But if I had had an older brother, for example, and he fulfilled one of those dreams, I'm not sure she would have pushed as hard. On the other hand...
Or she wouldn't have said, okay, just go ahead and marry one.
That she for
My
sure
mother
would
have
said. She for sure would not have said that. When people would come up to my mother in subsequent years and say, oh, you must be so proud of your daughters, she would always say, better they would be my sons-in-law. She always used the right grammar. So.
Well, Judy, you took your mom's advice and you went on to law school, Yale, I might add, not too shabby. How many women were in your class?
We were counting that. We're getting ready for our 40th reunion this fall. I believe there were 27. I might be off by one or two in one direction or the other. It was a very small class at Yale, I think 175, 178, something like that. What's interesting about you asking about the numbers is that one of the things we've all remarked on since is that we never felt that we were any kind of an affinity group. I mean, the women tried very hard just to be one of the guys. And it wasn't until I think we met for the first time, like our 25th reunion as a group of women and, you know, started talking to each other and talking about our stories. But we would have never done that. I mean, there was a little bit of it, but, you know, it wasn't a major force in the law school.
You weren't just the girls' pack.
Yeah, no.
So there wasn't a camaraderie among the women in the class.
You know, I've said that to people since, and some have said, no, yes, there really, really was. But I didn't really feel it. Most of my friends were other guys, and that was true of most of the women I knew.
And then you competed in a prize trial at Yale and became the first woman to win. And again, your mom was kind of orchestrating things, although not on purpose this time. So tell us the hysterical story.
Well, that was pretty funny. I was in this trial. It was my last year in law school. We actually had to do either a trial or an appellate argument in order to graduate. I put it off as long as I could. My third year, I elected to do the trial, and some strange twists of fate, I ended up in the prize trial competition. It was a couple of levels of competition. I was scared to death, and I was competing against three guys. We had two teams of two each, but we each were competing as individuals. And my parents, my mom would never fly. She just was terrified of flying. So they drove in from Cleveland the day before. That's where I grew up. And my mother and dad got to this auditorium where the prize trial was going to be very, very early. It was a full-day trial, and my mother found a seat. Mother and dad found a seat right in the middle row of the middle section, sort of spread out there. And I believe it was after lunch in the trial, we all knew we had prepared a lot and exchanged witness statements, but we all knew there would be a surprise witness at some point, but only one, and we didn't know who was going to get that witness. But it was the only person that you really wouldn't have been able to prepare your cross-examination for. I just was very intense participating in the trial, and in comes a surprise witness, and it's going to be my turn to cross-examine. And so I'm really nervous, and I start to listen quite intently, and then I hear somebody from somewhere back in the room calling, Judy, Judy, and I turn around, and it's my mother, and I look at her, and she says to me in a very loud whisper, honey, you ought to get your hair cut like that girl over there. You'd look adorable. And I looked at her, and I was just astounded, and I realized that she was sitting there for hours thinking, oh, isn't she cute, and isn't this fun? And that's something she would have clearly never done with a son. And next thing I knew, it was very short direct, and I turned around, and the opposing counsel said to me, "Miss Harris, it's your witness." And I thought, oh, my God, I have no idea what this guy has just testified to, and I'm just going to have to pass, and there goes all that preparation. And then I just thought, well, and I took a calculated risk, and I walked right up to the witness stand, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, "Sir, I only have one question for you." And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Do you think I ought to get my hair cut like that girl over there," pointing to the girl that my mother had pointed out? And the place cracked up. Enough people had heard my mother. The judge just couldn't stop laughing. He was a very big civil rights judge who had done some very big decisions, very renowned guy, and he just couldn't stop laughing. And I was completely convinced that that's why I won that trial.
With us, Washington, D.C. lawyer Judy Harris. She's talking about her experiences as a trailblazing attorney at a time when young female lawyers were a rare breed. Judy, you were at Yale with the Clintons. Did you actually know them?
I did. It was a small class, and Hillary was actually my advisor for that prize trial.
Oh, really? And what were they like?
Well, I think they were pretty much the way everybody's reported and the way that we've come to know them. I watched that romance develop in the law school library, like we've all heard. And she was and is a very intelligent, very hardworking gal. She was kind of his uptown gal. He had big hair and was a really fun-loving guy. And yeah. And I think, you know, and he always had these aspirations, but everybody thought that was so cute. Yes, yes, Bill, right. And because he was just a very charming guy. And I think in a lot of ways, although they were at the extremes of competence and intelligence and charm and charisma, still, in many ways, I think they each represented their gender at the law school. I think Hillary worked so hard to be taken seriously, be given the challenges that she clearly was so competent to handle. And I think Bill was a little more laid back about it, very politically involved always, a really fun-loving guy. But they had a serious romance and attraction to each other that I believe is incredibly strong to this day.
After you graduated, you had lots of job offers, but we understand you couldn't get a job doing litigation. So why was that?
That was at the biggest law firms. I think that they were really frightened that the clients weren't ready to accept it. And I'm quite short in addition to being a woman. And I think there was this feeling, A, that I couldn't hold my own, and B, that the clients wouldn't be ready to accept that. I left my law firm actually to go into the government and litigate for a while. And when I came back, they promised me that I could, you know, get into the courtroom a lot more, take depositions, which I hadn't been allowed to do before. And my actual first deposition was out in Prince George's County, actually, and it involved a front-end alignment machine from Chrysler. And I had won a big case on summary judgment for Chrysler, so they decided I could do this. And I had won on the papers. And I went to depose this car mechanic, and I learned everything there was to know about a front-end alignment machine. And when we walked into the deposition room, the person I was going to be deposing stood up and looked around and said, "Who's going to be questioning me?" And his lawyer said, "Miss Harris over here." And he walked out of the room and said, "I will not be deposed by a woman." And the transcript of my first deposition reads, well, that we go on the record, that I repeat that he won't let me depose him. But I think the amazing part of the story is when I got back to my law firm and I reported on what had happened, the reaction of a very dear friend and mentor of mine, now deceased, was, "Now you understand, Judy, why we can't send you to court." And I assumed he'd go to court and file for fees and everything like that. But instead, he wrote off all of my time so that the client didn't have to pay for any of my preparation and I didn't get credit for it. And I kind of accepted that. That's how things were.
Washington lawyer Judy Harris, we are so glad times have changed. Thanks so much for sharing your story with the Two Boomer Babes.
Up next, the Babes shoot the breeze about celebrating the big 5-0, 50 ways. Stay with us.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save...
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of...
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate... mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
So you're about to turn the big 5-0. Our next guest says her initial reaction to this milestone was, and I quote, a tsunami of depressive symptoms punctuated by existential angst and garnished with self-pity. Then she decided that her 50th birthday would be different. Why not use it as an excuse to have a fabulous year? And that's what psychologist Lisa Kyle did. She realized she was onto something, so she wrote the book, 50 Ways to Enjoy Turning 50. Lisa joins us from Seattle to shoot the breeze with the babes. Welcome, Lisa.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Lisa, in traditional cultures, the elderly are revered. In ours, however, there's a disdain for growing older. Our culture says, bring on the Botox and the buttocks. Why on earth is it so difficult for some of us to embrace these big birthdays? I mean, after all, at least we're alive and kicking.
Well, I myself blame Hollywood. Living in the entertainment capital of the year for this last decade, where plastic surgery is a national pastime, there are images in our entertainment, in the magazines, on the film, on the television. Everyone looks so beautiful. And the focus is really a youth culture. So there is a lot of pressure to look younger, to be younger, to act younger. And the great thing about 50 is that you can look at what's actually important to you, not the images that you're getting from different media.
Right. It's kind of liberating.
Yeah.
So, Lisa, when you turned 50, you decided you would do at least 50 things you always wanted to do. So let's talk about a few of your great ideas. One was to pick a theme for the year. What do you mean by that?
The idea is to do what's important to you, not what society says, not what your dad says, not what your childhood chum says. So for some people, it's an opportunity to just relax, to really focus on chilling and being very nurturing of themselves. For other people, it might be, wow, this is an opportunity to do adventures. I'm going to travel. I want to do these, you know, take things off the bucket list. For others, it might be a time of really deepening important relationships. So the idea of the theme is to come up with, you know, what is it that you need at this point in life? For me, it was fun. I really wanted to have fun.
And then I also liked your suggestion about decide where you're going to celebrate the big day. It's really important, isn't it, to decide who we want to spend it with.
Yes, and not just the day, but the point of the book is to be thinking about that all the way through the 12 months. You can't always gather together the people that are important to you for a big celebration, but you've got a whole year that you can go and visit with each other, that you can make a point of even reconnecting with hidden gems from your past. As you reflect back on your life and you think about who's important, maybe there's someone, you know, that you were really close to, but you aren't right now for whatever reason. Why not use 50 as an opportunity to reach out to that person?
Right. Reach out to that old college roommate, right?
Exactly.
And then you say you identify activities you've always wanted to do. I mean, would this be the time, Lisa, we go out and get that tattoo?
Well, absolutely. In fact, a woman in my book club did just that.
Oh, she's a brave one.
Might as well go for it, right? Time's a ticking.
Her first tattoo at 50, and let me tell you, it was not petite. It was not a small. It was not a small tattoo.
And not on anything that can sag, I hope.
I love this one. Eliminate grudges and conflicts, and commit random acts of kindness.
Well, at 50, it's an opportunity for us to give to the community. And part of that is kind of getting your own self in order. What is it that you need to get rid of? And it might be physical things. But there's also a fair amount of baggage, regrets, disappointments, grudges. Why not use this as an opportunity to pack them away?
That's a great idea. And Barbara, I think this is your opportunity to give me that diamond ring of yours.
I think Kathy missed the community service part of this conversation. Dr. Lisa Kyle, author of 50 Ways to Enjoy Turning 50. Lisa, you've given those new to the Boomer Club lots of fabulous ideas for celebrating the moment. Thanks so much for sharing.
This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com. Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be. One Price Taxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free. And unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Barb, I don't know about you, but I can't walk into an animal shelter and come out empty-handed.
You know, that's why I don't even go near those places. But for those who can't resist, we've called a pro who can help us find and adopt just the right family pet. Animal advocate Marion Zola co-produced the PBS show Shelter Me, a program about shelter dogs, and she's the author of Romancing the Dog, The Struggle to Make a Pound Dog Happy in Beverly Hills. She joins us from California to shoot the breeze with the babes. Welcome, Marion.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marion, you know, pets can really transform our lives. I cannot imagine my life without all of my little pound puppies that I have. But when we go to a shelter looking to adopt our next family member, what besides adorable should we be looking for?
Well, first of all, you have to know what kind of family you have. If you have a family with small children, or if you have just two adults, it's a different thing. Two adults alone, you have different requirements than you do with dogs with small children. Fortunately, the shelter employees usually know their dogs pretty well, and they will do an assessment before putting the dog up for adoption. So they know which dogs would fit well with which people who come in to adopt. They have trainers who assess them, and they're very honest about the personality and pluses and minuses of all the dogs, because they don't want the poor animal to come back or to not have a successful adoption.
Right. Well, Marion, say they tell you that this dog has an issue, like maybe he bit the UPS man. He didn't kill him, but he might have maimed him slightly. Should we always stay away? I mean, is once a bad dog always a bad dog?
Absolutely not. You don't know the circumstances of that, and I would, again, have an evaluation by a trainer. You don't know if somebody grabbed the dog in a wrong way or caused him pain, but believe me, the documentation on dog bites or dog aggressiveness is so stringent in this country. I wish people were assessed half as stringently.
Yeah.
The poor animals, any little negative incident is completely recorded, and if there's a second incident, there are tremendous consequences. Even with a first incident, they're usually confined to the house for 10 days and they do an evaluation. It's very, very difficult. And being in contact with so many people who adopt, I can tell you that most adoptions are very successful.
That's great. So we can reform our dogs.
Absolutely.
Good. So tell us, what are the top three things we should be doing daily with our pets?
Okay. Well, one of the things to do is brush him, and that'll cut down a lot on the shedding. That makes a big difference. Even if it's just a few minutes, play with him. Give him undivided attention, because a lot of people just walk by their pets as if they're pieces of furniture and never really focus on the dog. And the dog is waiting, and the cat is waiting all day to get your exclusive attention. Play with him, even if it's just for a few minutes. And talk to the dog and even the cat. If they don't understand the specific words, they do get the tone.
Marion, one more question. If we are in the shelter and we see an adorable dog, is there some breed that if we know, if for example, a pit bull, if they're part pit bull, are there any breeds that we should just stay away from?
Well, I can't tell you how many people I know with pit bulls that are the sweetest, most affectionate dogs you ever met. In England, they were known as the nanny dogs. They used to guard the children. Pit bull is a slang expression. They've gotten a terrible rap because of how they've been abused in this country with the dog fighting, and there have been a lot of incidents, but look what they've done to these animals. A lot of breeds, you know, have a bad reputation, but they're really not bad breeds. There's really no bad breed. If I had small children, I'd stay away from tiny dogs, because tiny dogs really can't defend themselves against the kind of tail pulling and ear pulling and fur pulling that a lot of kids do. And they will nip because they need to protect themselves.
Well, Marion Zola, animal advocate and author of Romancing the Dog, The Struggle to Make a Pound Dog Happy in Beverly Hills, thanks so much for great advice and for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and have a great day, and love your animals.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.